Side 2. Good Omens, The Nice and Accurate Prophecies of Agnes Nutter, Witch, by Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett. Continuing on page 33. Yeah, but my people are only in favor of disobedience in general terms. It's specific disobedience they come down on heavily.
Such as disobedience to themselves?
You've got it. You'd be amazed. Or perhaps you wouldn't be. How long do you think we've got?
Crowley waved a hand at the Bentley, which unlocked its doors.
The prophecies differ,
said Azrafael, sliding into the passenger seat.
Certainly until the end of the century, although we may expect certain phenomena before then. Most of the prophets of the past millennium were more concerned with scansion than accuracy.
Crowley pointed to the ignition key. It turned.
What?
He said.
You know, said the angel helpfully.
And the world unto an end shall come in tumpty-tumpty-tumpty-one,
or two, or three, or whatever. There aren't many good rhymes for six, so it's probably a good year to be in.
And what sort of phenomena?
Two-headed calves, signs in the sky, geese flying backwards, showers of fish, that sort of thing.
The presence of the Antichrist affects the natural operation of causality. Crowley put the Bentley in gear. Then he remembered something. He snapped his fingers. The wheel clamps disappeared.
Let's have lunch, he said. I owe you one from... when was it?
Paris, 1793, said Azrafael.
Oh, yes, the Reign of Terror.
Was that one of yours, or one of ours?
Wasn't it yours?
Can't recall.
It was quite a good restaurant, though.
As they drove past an astonished traffic warden, his notebook spontaneously combusted, to Crowley's amazement.
I'm pretty certain I didn't mean to do that, he said.
Azrafael blushed.
That was me, he said. I had always thought that your people invented them.
Did you?
We thought they were yours.
Crowley stared at the smoke in the rearview mirror.
Come on, he said. Let's do the writs.
Crowley had not bothered to book. In his world, table reservations were things that happened to other people.
Azrafael collected books. If he were totally honest with himself, he would have to have admitted that his bookshop was simply somewhere to store them.
He was not unusual in this. In order to maintain his cover as a typical second-hand bookseller, he used every means short of actual physical violence to prevent customers from making a purchase. Unpleasant damp smells, glowering looks, erratic opening hours. He was incredibly good at it. He had been collecting for a long time, and, like all collectors, he specialized. He had more than 60 books of predictions concerning developments in the last handful of centuries of the second millennium. He had a penchant for wild first editions, and he had a complete set of the infamous Bibles, individually named from errors in typesetting. These Bibles included the Unrighteous Bible, so called from a printer's error which caused it to proclaim in 1 Corinthians, "Know ye not that the unrighteous shall inherit the kingdom of God?" And the Wicked Bible, printed by Barker and Lucas in 1632, in which the word not was omitted from the seventh commandment, making it, "Thou shalt commit adultery." There were the Discharge Bible, the Treacle Bible, the Standing Fishes Bible, the Charing Cross Bible, and the rest. Azrafael had them all. Even the very rarest, a Bible published in 1651, by the London publishing firm of Bilton and Skaggs. It had been the first of their three great publishing disasters. The book was commonly known as the Bugger All This Bible, the lengthy compositor's error, if such it may be called, occurs in the book of Ezekiel, chapter 48, verse 5. 2. And by the border of Dan, from the east side to the west side, a portion for Asher. 3. And by the border of Asher, from the east side even unto the west side, a portion for Naphtali. 4. And by the border of Naphtali, from the east side unto the west side, a portion for Manasseh. 5. Bugger all this for a lark. I am sick to my heart of typesetting. Master Bilton is no gentleman, and Master Skaggs no more than a tight-fisted Southwark knobstick. I tell you, on a day like this, anyone with half an ounce of sense should be out in the sunshine, and not stuck here all the livelong day in this moldy old By Our Lady workshop. At asterisk, quotation marks, A.E., at, semicolon, exclamation point, asterisk. 6. And by the border of Ephraim, from the east side even unto the west side, a portion for Reuben. Note. The Bugger All This Bible was also noteworthy for having 27 verses in the third chapter of Genesis instead of the more usual 24. They followed verse 24, which in the King James Version reads, So he drove out the man, and he placed at the east of the Garden of Eden cherubims and a flaming sword which turned every way to keep the way of the tree of life. And read, 25. And the Lord spake unto the angel that guarded the eastern gate, saying, Where is the flaming sword which was given unto thee? 26. And the angel said, I had it here only a moment ago. I must have put it down somewhere, or get my own head next. 27. And the Lord did not ask him again. It appears that these verses were inserted during the proof stage. In those days, it was common practice for printers to hang proof sheets to the wooden beams outside their shops, for the edification of the populace, and some free proofreading. And since the whole print run was subsequently burned anyway, no one bothered to take up this matter with the nice Mr. A. Zirafale, who ran the bookshop two doors along, and was always so helpful with the translations, and whose handwriting was instantly recognizable. End note. Bilton and Skaggs' second great publishing disaster occurred in 1653. By a stroke of rare good fortune, they had obtained one of the famed Lost Quartos, the three Shakespeare plays never reissued in folio edition, and now totally lost to scholars and playgoers. Only their names have come down to us. This one was Shakespeare's earliest play, The Comedy of Robin Hood, or The Forest of Sherwood. Note, the other two are The Trapping of the Mouse and Gold Diggers of 1589. End note. Master Bilton had paid almost 6 guineas for the quarto and believed he could make nearly twice that much back on the hardcover folio alone. Then he lost it. Bilton and Skaggs' third great publishing disaster was never entirely comprehensible to either of them. Everywhere you looked, books of prophecy were selling like crazy. The English edition of Nostradamus's Centuries had just gone into its third printing, and 5 Nostradamuses, all claiming to be the only genuine one, were on triumphant signing tours. And Mother Shipton's Collection of Prophecies was sprinting out of the shops. Each of the great London publishers, there were 8 of them, had at least 1 book of prophecy on its list. Every single one of the books was wildly inaccurate, but their air of vague and generalized omnipotence made them immensely popular. They sold in the thousands and in the tens of thousands. It is a license to print money, said Master Bilton to Master Skaggs. Note, who had already had a few thoughts in that direction, and spent the last years of his life in Newgate Prison when he eventually put them into practice. End note. The public are crying out for such rubbish. We must straightway print a book of prophecy by some hag. The manuscript arrived at their door the next morning. The author's sense of timing, as always, was exact. Although neither Master Bilton nor Master Skaggs realized it, the manuscript they had been sent was the sole prophetic work in all of human history to consist entirely of completely correct predictions concerning the following 340-odd years, being a precise and accurate description of the events that would culminate in Armageddon. It was on the money in every single detail. It was published by Bilton and Skaggs in September 1655, in good time for the Christmas trade. Note, another master stroke of publishing genius, because Oliver Cromwell's Puritan Parliament had made Christmas illegal in 1654. End note. And it was the first book printed in England to be remaindered. It didn't sell. Not even the copy in the tiny Lancashire shop with local author on a piece of cardboard next to it. The author of the book, one Agnes Nutter, was not surprised by this, but then it would have taken an awful lot to surprise Agnes Nutter. Anyway, she had not written it for the sales, or the royalties, or even for the fame. She had written it for the single gratis copy of the book that an author was entitled to. No one knows what happened to the legions of unsold copies of her book. Certainly, none remain in any museums or private collections. Even Aziraphale does not possess a copy, but would go weak at the knees at the thought of actually getting his exquisitely manicured hands on one. In fact, only one copy of Agnes Nutter's prophecies remained in the entire world. It was on a bookshelf about 40 miles away from where Crowley and Aziraphale were enjoying a rather good lunch, and, metaphorically, it had just begun to tick. And now it was 3 o'clock. The Antichrist had been on earth for 15 hours, and one angel and one demon had been drinking solidly for 3 of them. They sat opposite one another in the back room of Aziraphale's dingy old bookshop in Soho. Most bookshops in Soho have back rooms, and most of the back rooms are filled with rare, or at least very expensive, books. But Aziraphale's books didn't have illustrations. They had old brown covers and crackling pages. Occasionally, if he had no alternative, he'd sell one. And occasionally, serious men in dark suits would come calling and suggest, very politely, that perhaps he'd like to sell the shop itself, so that it could be turned into the kind of retail outlet more suited to the area. Sometimes they'd offer cash in large rolls of grubby 50-pound notes. Or sometimes, while they were talking, other men in dark glasses would wander around the shop shaking their heads and saying how inflammable paper was, and what a fire trap he had here. And Aziraphale would nod and smile and say that he'd think about it. And then they'd go away. And they'd never come back. Just because you're an angel doesn't mean you have to be a fool. The table in front of the two of them was covered with bottles. "The point is," said Crowley, "the point is, the point is," he tried to focus on Aziraphale, "the point is," he said, and tried to think of a point. "The point I'm trying to make," he said, brightening, "is the dolphins. That's my point." "Kind of fish," said Aziraphale. "No, no, no, no," said Crowley, shaking a finger. "It's mammal. Your actual mammal. Difference is..." Crowley waded through the swamp of his mind and tried to remember the difference. "Difference is they mate out of water," volunteered Aziraphale. Crowley's brow furrowed. "Don't think so. Pretty sure that's not it. Something about their young, whatever."
He pulled himself together.
The point is, their brains.
He reached for a bottle.
What about their brains?
Said the angel.
Big brains. That's my point. Size of damn big brains. And then there's the whales. Brain City. Take it from me. Whole damn sea full of brains.
Kraken,
said Azrafael, staring moodily into his glass. Crowley gave him the long, cool look of someone who has just had a girder dropped in front of his train of thought.
Huh? Great big bugger,
said Azrafael.
Sleepeth beneath the thunders of the upper deep, under loads of huge and unnumbered polypal, bloody great seaweeds, you know. Supposed to rise to the surface right at the end when the sea boils.
Yeah.
Fact.
There you are then, said Crowley, sitting back. Whole sea bubbling, poor old dolphin, so much seafood gumbo, no one giving a damn. Same with gorillas. Whoops, they say. Sky gone all red, stars crashing to ground. What they putting in the bananas these days? And then...
They make nests, you know, gorillas,
said the angel, pouring another drink and managing to hit the glass on the third go.
Nah. God's truth. Saw a film. Nests.
That's birds, said Crowley.
Nests,
insisted Azrafael. Crowley decided not to argue the point.
There you are, then, he said. All creatures great and small. I mean small. Great and small. Lots of them with brains. And then, bazam.
But you're part of it, said Azrafael. You tempt people. You're good at it.
Crowley thumped his glass on the table.
That's different. They don't have to say yes. That's the ineffable bit, right? Your side made it up. You've got to keep testing people, but not to destruction.
All right. I don't like it any more than you, but I told you. I can't not do what I'm told. I'm an angel.
There's no theaters in heaven, said Crowley, and very few films.
Don't you try to tempt me, said
Azrafael wretchedly.
I know you, you old serpent.
Just you think about it, said Crowley relentlessly. You know what eternity is? You know what eternity is? I mean, do you know what eternity is? There's this big mountain, see? A mile high at the end of the universe. And once every 1,000 years, there's this little bird.
What little bird?
Said Azrafael suspiciously.
This little bird I'm talking about. And every 1,000 years.
The same bird every 1,000 years?
Crowley hesitated.
Yeah,
he said.
Bloody ancient bird, then.
Okay. And every 1,000 years, this bird flies
limp.
Flies all the way to this mountain and sharpens its beak.
Hold on. You can't do that. Between here and the end of the universe, there's loads of...
The angel waved a hand expansively, if a little unsteadily.
Loads of bugger-all, dear boy.
But it gets there anyway,
Crowley persevered.
How?
It doesn't matter.
It could use a spaceship,
said the angel. Crowley subsided a bit.
Yeah, he said, if you like. Anyway, this bird.
Only it is the end of the universe we're talking about,
said Azrafael.
So it'd have to be one of those spaceships where your descendants
are the ones who get out at the other end. You have to tell your descendants. You say, when you get to the mountain, you've got to...
He hesitated.
What have they got to do? Sharpen its beak on the mountain, said Crowley. And then it flies back in the spaceship, and after 1,000 years, it goes and does it all again, said Crowley quickly.
There was a moment of drunken silence.
Seems a lot of effort just to sharpen a beak, mused Azrael. Listen, said Crowley urgently, the point is that when the bird has worn the mountain down to nothing, right then...
Azrael opened his mouth.
Crowley just knew he was going to make some point about the relative hardness of birds' beaks and granite mountains, and plunged on quickly. Then you still won't have finished watching The Sound of Music.
Azrael froze.
And you'll enjoy it, Crowley said relentlessly. You really will. My dear boy, you won't have a choice. Listen, heaven has no taste. Now, and not one single sushi restaurant.
A look of pain crossed the angel's suddenly very serious face.
I can't cope with this while I'm drunk, he said. I'm going to sober up. Me too.
They both winced as the alcohol left their bloodstreams and sat up a bit more neatly. Azrael straightened his tie.
I can't interfere with divine plans, he croaked.
Crowley looked speculatively into his glass and then filled it again.
What about diabolical ones? He said.
Pardon?
Well, it's got to be a diabolical plan, hasn't it? We're doing it. My side.
Ah, but it's all part of the overall divine plan, said Azrael. Your side can't do anything without it being part of the ineffable divine plan, he added with a trace of smugness.
You wish.
No, that's the...
Azrael snapped his finger irritably.
The thing... Do you call it in your colorful idiom? The line at the bottom.
The bottom line.
Yes, it's that.
Well, if you're sure,
said Crowley.
No doubt about it.
Crowley looked up slyly.
Then you can't be certain, correct me if I'm wrong, you can't be certain that thwarting it isn't part of the divine plan, too. I mean, you're supposed to thwart the wiles of the evil one at every turn, aren't you?
Azrael hesitated.
There is that, yes.
You see a wile, you thwart, am I right?
Broadly, broadly.
Actually, I encourage humans to do the actual thwarting because of ineffability, you understand.
Right, right.
So all you've got to do is thwart. Because if I know anything, said Crowley urgently, it's that the birth is just the start. It's the upbringing that's important. It's the influences. Otherwise, the child will never learn to use its powers.
He hesitated.
At least, not necessarily as intended. Certainly our side won't mind me thwarting you, said Azrael thoughtfully.
They won't mind that at all.
Right. It'd be a real feather in your wing.
Crowley gave the angel an encouraging smile.
What will happen to the child if it doesn't get a satanic upbringing, though?
Said Azrael.
Probably nothing. It'll never know.
But genetics.
Don't tell me from genetics. What have they got to do with it? Said Crowley. Look at Satan. Created as an angel. Grows up to be the great adversary. Hey, if you're going to go on about genetics, you might as well say the kid will grow up to be an angel. After all, his father was really big in heaven in the old days. Saying he'll grow up to be a demon just because his dad became one
It's like saying a mouse with its tail cut off will give birth to tailless mice. No, upbringing is everything. Take it from me.
And without unopposed satanic influences...
Well, at worst, hell will have to start all over again. And the Earth gets at least another 11 years. That's got to be worth something, hasn't it?
Now Azrafael was looking thoughtful again. You're saying the child isn't evil of itself? He said slowly.
Potentially evil. Potentially good, too, I suppose. Just this huge, powerful potentiality waiting to be shaped, said Crowley. He shrugged. Anyway, why are we talking about this good and evil? They're just names for sides. We know that.
I suppose it's got to be worth a try, said the angel.
Crowley nodded encouragingly. Agreed, said the demon, holding out his hand.
The angel shook it, cautiously. It'll certainly be more interesting than saints, he said.
And it'll be for the child's own good in the long run, said Crowley. We'll be godfathers, sort of. Overseeing his religious upbringing, you might say.
Azrafael beamed. You know, I'd never have thought of that, he said.
Godfathers! Well, I'll be damned. It's not too bad, said Crowley, when you get used to it. She was known as Scarlet. At that time she was selling arms, although it was beginning to lose its savor. She never stuck at one job for very long, 300-400 years at the outside. You didn't want to get in a rut. Her hair was true auburn, neither ginger nor brown, but deep and burnished copper color, and it fell to her waist in tresses that men would kill for, and indeed often had. Her eyes were a startling orange. She looked 25, and always had. She had a dusty, brick-red truck full of assorted weaponry, and an almost unbelievable skill at getting it across any border in the world. She had been on her way to a small West African country, where a minor civil war was in progress, to make a delivery which would, with any luck, turn it into a major civil war. Unfortunately, the truck had broken down, far beyond even her ability to repair it. And she was very good with machinery these days. She was in the middle of a city. Note, nominally a city. It was the size of an English county town, or, translated into American terms, a shopping mall. End note. At the time, the city in question was the capital of Kambolaland, an African nation which had been at peace for the last 3,000 years. For about 30 years, it was Sir Humphrey Clarkson Land. But since the country had absolutely no mineral wealth and the strategic importance of a banana, it was accelerated towards self-government with almost unseemly haste. Kambolaland was poor, perhaps, and undoubtedly boring, but peaceful. Its various tribes, who got along with one another quite happily, had long since beaten their swords into plowshares. A fight had broken out in the city square in 1952 between a drunken ox drover and an equally drunken ox thief. People were still talking about it. Scarlet yawned in the heat. She fanned her head with her broad-brimmed hat, left the useless truck in the dusty street, and wandered into a bar. She bought a can of beer, drained it, then grinned at the barman. "I got a truck needs repairing," she said. "Anyone around I can talk to?" The barman grinned white and huge and expansively. He'd been impressed by the way she drank her beer. "Only Nathan, miss. But Nathan has gone back to Kawanda to see his father-in-law's farm." Scarlet bought another beer. "So, this Nathan, any idea when he'll be back?"
"Perhaps next week.
Perhaps 2 weeks' time, dear lady. Oh, that Nathan, he is a scamp, no?
He leaned forward.
You traveling alone, miss? He said.
Yes.
Could be dangerous. Some funny people on the roads these days. Bad men. Not local boys, he added quickly.
Scarlet raised a perfect eyebrow. Despite the heat, he shivered.
Thanks for the warning, Scarlet purred.
Her voice sounded like something that lurks in the long grass, visible only by the twitching of its ears, until something young and tender wobbles by. She tipped her hat to him and strolled outside. The hot African sun beat down on her. Her truck sat in the street with a cargo of guns and ammunition and landmines. It wasn't going anywhere. Scarlet stared at the truck. A vulture was sitting on his roof. It had traveled 300 miles with Scarlet so far. It was belching quietly. She looked around the street. A couple of women chatted on a street corner. A bored market vendor sat in front of a heap of colored gourds, fanning the flies. A few children played lazily in the dust.
What the hell, she said quietly. I could do with a holiday anyway.
That was Wednesday. By Friday, the city was a no-go area. By the following Tuesday, the economy of Kombola Land was shattered. 20,000 people were dead, including the barman shot by the rebels while storming the market barricades. Almost 100,000 people were injured. All of Scarlet's assorted weapons had fulfilled the function for which they had been created, and the vulture had died of greasy degeneration. Scarlet was already on the last train out of the country. It was time to move on, she felt. She'd been doing arms for too damn long. She wanted a change. Something with openings. She quite fancied herself as a newspaper journalist. A possibility. She fanned herself with her hat and crossed her long legs in front of her. Farther down the train, a fight broke out. Scarlet grinned. People were always fighting, over her and around her. It was rather sweet, really. Sable had black hair, a trim black beard, and he had just decided to go corporate. He did drinks with his accountant.
How we doing, Franny? He asked her.
12 million copies sold so far. Can you believe that?
They were doing drinks at a restaurant called Top of the Sixes, on the top of 666 Fifth Avenue, New York. This was something that amused Sable ever so slightly. From the restaurant windows, you could see the whole of New York. At night, the rest of New York could see the huge red 666s that adorned all four sides of the building. Of course, it was just another street number. If you started counting, you'd be bound to get to it eventually. But you had to smile. Sable and his accountant had just come from a small, expensive, and particularly exclusive restaurant in Greenwich Village, where the cuisine was entirely nouvelle. A string bean, a pea, and a sliver of chicken breast, aesthetically arranged on a square china plate. Sable had invented it the last time he'd been in Paris. His accountant had polished her meat and two veg off in under 50 seconds, and had spent the rest of the meal staring at the plate, the cutlery, and from time to time at her fellow diners, in a manner that suggested that she was wondering what they'd taste like, which was in fact the case. It had amused Sable enormously. He toyed with his Perrier.
12 million, huh? That's pretty good.
That's great.
So we're going corporate. It's time to blow the big one, am I right?
California, I think.
I want factories, restaurants, the whole schmear. We'll keep the publishing arm, but it's time to diversify, yeah?
Franny nodded.
Sounds good, Sable. We'll need...
She was interrupted by a skeleton. A skeleton in a Dior dress, with tanned skin stretched almost to snapping point over the delicate bones of the skull. The skeleton had long blonde hair and perfectly made-up lips. She looked like the person mothers around the world would point to, muttering, "That's what'll happen to you if you don't eat your greens." She looked like a famine relief poster with style. She was New York's top fashion model, and she was holding a book. She said,
Excuse me, Mr. Sable. I hope you don't mind me intruding, but your book, it changed my life. I was wondering, would you mind signing it for me?
She stared imploringly at him with eyes deep sunk in gloriously eye-shadowed sockets. Sable nodded graciously and took the book from her. It was not surprising that she had recognized him, for his dark gray eyes stared out from his photo on the foil-embossed cover. "Foodless Dieting, Slim Yourself Beautiful," the book was called. The diet book of the century. "How do you spell your name?" he asked.
"Cheryl, 2 R's, 1 Y, 1 L.
"You remind me of an old, old friend," he told her, as he wrote swiftly and carefully on the title page. "There you go. Glad you liked it. Always good to meet a fan." What he'd written was this: "Cheryl, a measure of wheat for a penny, and 3 measures of barley for a penny, and see thou hurt not the oil and the wine." Revelations, chapter 6, verse 6. Dr. Raven Sable. "It's from the Bible," he told her. She closed the book reverently and backed away from the table, thanking Sable. He didn't know how much this meant to her. He had changed her life. Truly he had. He had never actually earned the medical degree he claimed, since there hadn't been any universities in those days. But Sable could see she was starving to death. He gave her a couple of months at the outside. Foodless. Handle your weight problem terminally. Franny was stabbing at her laptop computer hungrily, planning the next phase in Sable's transformation of the eating habits of the Western world. Sable had bought her the machine as a personal present. It was very, very expensive, very powerful, and ultra-slim. He liked slim things.
"There's a European outfit we can buy into for the initial toehold. Holdings, Incorporated. That'll give us the Liechtenstein tax base. Now, if we channel funds out through the Caymans into Luxembourg, and from there to Switzerland, we could pay for the factories in..."
But Sable was no longer listening. He was remembering the exclusive little restaurant. It had occurred to him that he had never seen so many rich people so hungry. Sable grinned, the honest, open grin that goes with job satisfaction, perfect and pure. He was just killing time until the main event, but he was killing it in such exquisite ways. Time, and sometimes people. Sometimes he was called White, or Blanc, or Albus, or Chalky, or Weiss, or Snowy, or any one of 100 other names. His skin was pale, his hair a faded blonde, his eyes light gray. He was somewhere in his 20s at a casual glance, and the casual glance was all anyone ever gave him. He was almost entirely unmemorable. Unlike his 2 colleagues, he could never settle down in any one job for very long. He had had all manner of interesting jobs in lots of interesting places. He had worked at the Chernobyl power station, and at Windscale, and at Three Mile Island, always in minor jobs that weren't very important. He had been a minor but valued member of a number of scientific research establishments. He had helped to design the petrol engine and plastics and the ring pull can. He could turn his hand to anything. Nobody really noticed him. He was unobtrusive. His presence was cumulative. If you thought about it carefully,
you could figure out he had to have been doing something, had to have been somewhere. Maybe he even spoke to you. But he was easy to forget, was Mr. White. At this time, he was working as deckhand on an oil tanker, heading toward Tokyo. The captain was drunk in his cabin. The first mate was in the head. The second mate was in the galley. That was pretty much it for the crew. The ship was almost completely automated. There wasn't much a person could do. However, if a person just happened to press the emergency cargo release switch on the bridge, the automatic systems would take care of releasing huge quantities of black sludge into the sea, millions of tons of crude oil, with devastating effect on the birds, fish, vegetation, animals, and humans of the region. Of course, there were dozens of fail-safe interlocks and foolproof safety backups, but what the hell? There always were. Afterwards, there was a huge amount of argument as to exactly whose fault it was. In the end, it was left unresolved. The blame was apportioned equally. Neither the captain, the first mate, nor the second mate ever worked again. For some reason, nobody gave much of a thought to Seaman White, who was already halfway to Indonesia on a tramp steamer piled high with rusting metal barrels of a particularly toxic weed killer. And there was another. He was in the square in Kambola Land, and he was in the restaurants, and he was in the fish, and in the air, and in the barrels of weed killer. He was on the roads, and in houses, and in palaces, and in hovels. There was nowhere that he was a stranger, and there was no getting away from him. He was doing what he did best, and what he was doing was what he was. He was not waiting. He was working. Harriet Dowling returned home with her baby, which, on the advice of Sister Faith Prolix, who was more persuasive than Sister Mary, and with the telephonic agreement of her husband, she had named Warlock. The cultural attaché returned home a week later and pronounced the baby the spit of his side of the family. He also had his secretary advertise in The Lady for a nanny. Crowley had seen Mary Poppins on television one Christmas. Indeed, behind the scenes, Crowley had had a hand in most television, although it was on the invention of the game show that he truly prided himself. He toyed with the idea of a hurricane as an effective and incredibly stylish way of disposing of the queue of nannies that would certainly form, or possible stack up in a holding pattern, outside the cultural attaché's Regent's Park residence. He contented himself with a wildcat tube strike, and when the day came, only one nanny turned up. She wore a knit tweed suit and discreet pearl earrings. Something about her might have said nanny, but it said it in an undertone of the sort employed by British butlers in a certain type of American film. It also coughed discreetly and muttered that she could well be the sort of nanny who advertises unspecified but strangely explicit services in certain magazines. Her flat shoes crunched up the gravel drive, and the gray dog padded silently by her side, white flecks of saliva dripping from its jaw. Its eyes glinted scarlet, and it glanced from side to side hungrily. She reached the heavy wooden door, smiled to herself, a brief, satisfied flicker, and rang the bell. It donged gloomily. The door was opened by a butler, as they say, of the old school. Note, a night school just off the Tottenham Court Road, run by an elderly actor who had played butlers and gentlemen's gentlemen in films and television and on the stage since the 1920s. End note. "I am Nanny Ashtruth," she told him. "And this," she continued, while the gray dog at her side eyed the butler carefully, working out perhaps where it would bury the bones, "is Rover." She left the dog in the garden and passed her interview with flying colors, and Mrs. Dowling led the nanny to see her new charge. She smiled unpleasantly. "What a delightful child," she said. "He'll be wanting a little tricycle soon." By one of those coincidences, another new member of staff arrived the same afternoon. He was the gardener, and as it turned out, he was amazingly good at his job. No one quite worked out why this should be the case, since he never seemed to pick up a shovel and made no effort to rid the garden of the sudden flocks of birds that filled it and settled all over him at every opportunity. He just sat in the shade while, around him, the residence gardens bloomed and bloomed. Warlock used to come down to see him when he was old enough to toddle, and Nanny was doing whatever it was she did on her afternoons off. "This here's Brother Slug," the gardener would tell him, "and this tiny little critter is Sister Potato Weevil. Remember, Warlock, as you walk your way through the highways and byways of life's rich and fulsome path, to have love and reverence for all living things."
"Nanny says that living things is fit only to be ground under my heels, Mr. Francis," said little Warlock, stroking Brother Slug, and then wiping his hand conscientiously on his Kermit the Frog overall.
"You don't listen to that woman," Francis would say. "You listen to me." At night, Nanny Ashtoreth sang nursery rhymes to Warlock. "Oh, the grand old Duke of York, he had 10,000 men. He marched them up to the top of the hill and crushed all the nations of the world and brought them under the rule of Satan, our master." And, "This little piggy went to Hades. This little piggy stayed home. This little piggy ate raw and steaming human flesh. This little piggy violated virgins. And this little piggy clambered over a heap of dead bodies to get to the top."
"Brother Francis, the gardener, says that I must selflessly practice virtue and love to all living things," said Warlock.
"You don't listen to that man, darling," the nanny would whisper as she tucked him into his little bed. "You listen to me." And so it went. The arrangement worked perfectly. A no-score win. Nanny Ashtoreth bought the child a little tricycle, but could never persuade him to ride it inside the house. And he was scared of Rover. In the background, Crowley and Aziraphale met on the tops of buses and in art galleries and at concerts, compared notes, and smiled. When Warlock was six, his nanny left, taking Rover with her. The gardener handed in his resignation on the same day. Neither of them left with quite the same spring in their step with which they'd arrived. Warlock now found himself being educated by two tutors. Mr. Harrison taught him about Attila the Hun, Vlad Dracul, and the darkness intrinsicate in the human spirit. Note: he avoided mentioning that Attila was nice to his mother, or that Vlad Dracul was punctilious about saying his prayers every day. End note. He tried to teach Warlock how to make rabble-rousing political speeches to sway the hearts and minds of multitudes. Mr. Cortese taught him about Florence Nightingale. Note: except for the bits about syphilis. End note. Abraham Lincoln and the appreciation of art. He tried to teach him about free will, self-denial, and doing unto others as you would wish them to do to you. They both read to the child extensively from the Book of Revelation. Despite their best efforts, Warlock showed a regrettable tendency to be good at maths. Neither of his tutors was entirely satisfied with his progress. When Warlock was 10, he liked baseball. He liked plastic toys that transformed into other plastic toys indistinguishable from the first set of plastic toys, except to the trained eye. He liked his stamp collection. He liked banana flavor bubble gum. He liked comics and cartoons and his BMX bike. Crowley was troubled.
They were in the cafeteria of the British Museum, another refuge for all weary foot soldiers of the Cold War. At the table to their left, two ramrod-straight Americans in suits were surreptitiously handing over a briefcase full of deniable dollars to a small, dark woman in sunglasses. At the table on their right, the deputy head of MI7 and a local KGB section officer argued over who got to keep the receipt for the tea and buns. Crowley finally said what he had not even dared to think for the last decade. "If you ask me," Crowley said to his counterpart, "he's too bloody normal." Aziraphale popped another deviled egg into his mouth and washed it down with coffee. He dabbed his lips with a paper napkin. "It's my good influence," he beamed. "Or rather, credit where credit's due, that of my little team." Crowley shook his head. "I'm taking that into account. Look, by now he should be trying to warp the world around him to his own desires, shaping it in his own image, that kind of stuff. Well, not actually trying. He'll do it without even knowing it. Have you seen any evidence of that happening?" "Well, no, but..." "By now, he should be a powerhouse of raw force. Is he?"
"Well, not as far as I noticed, but..."
"He's too normal." Crowley drummed his fingers on the table. "I don't like it. There's something wrong. I just can't put my finger on it." Aziraphale helped himself to Crowley's slice of angel cake.
"Well, he's a growing boy. And, of course, there's been the heavenly influence in his life."
Crowley sighed. "I just hope he'll know how to cope with a hellhound, that's all." Aziraphale raised one eyebrow.
"Hellhound?"
"On his 11th birthday. I received a message from hell last night." The message had come during Golden Girls, one of Crowley's favorite television programs. Rose had taken 10 minutes to deliver what could have been quite a brief communication, and by the time non-infernal service was restored, Crowley had quite lost the thread of the plot. "They're sending him a hellhound to pad by his side and guard him from all harm. Biggest one they've got."
"Won't people remark on the sudden appearance of a huge black dog? His parents, for a start."
Crowley stood up suddenly, treading on the foot of a Bulgarian cultural attaché, who was talking animatedly to the keeper of Her Majesty's antiques. "Nobody's going to notice anything out of the ordinary. It's reality, Angel, and young Warlock can do what he wants to that, whether he knows it or not."
"When does it turn up, then? This dog? Does it have a name?"
"I told you, on his 11th birthday, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It'll sort of home in on him. He's supposed to name it himself. It's very important that he names it himself. It gives it its purpose. It'll be Killer, or Terror, or Stalks by Night, I expect."
"Are you going to be there?"
asked the Angel nonchalantly. "Wouldn't miss it for the worlds," said Crowley. "I do hope there's nothing too wrong with the child. We'll see how he reacts to the dog anyway. That should tell us something. I hope he'll send it back or be frightened of it. If he does name it, we've lost. He'll have all his powers, and Armageddon is just around the corner."
"I think," said Aziraphale, sipping his wine, which had just ceased to be a slightly vinegary Beaujolais and had become a quite acceptable but rather surprised Chateau Lafite, 1875, "I think I'll see you there."
Wednesday. It was a hot, fume-filled August day in central London. Warlock's 11th birthday was very well attended. There were 20 small boys and 17 small girls. There were a lot of men with identical blonde crew cuts, dark blue suits, and shoulder holsters. There was a crew of caterers who had arrived bearing jellies, cakes, and bowls of crisps. their procession of vans was led by a vintage Bentley. The amazing Harvey and Wanda, children's parties a specialty, had both been struck down by an unexpected tummy bug, but by a providential turn of fortune, a replacement had turned up, practically out of the blue, a stage magician. Everyone has his little hobby. Despite Crowley's urgent advice, Aziraphale was intending to turn his to good use. Aziraphale was particularly proud of his magical skills. He had attended a class in the 1870s run by John Maskelyne, and had spent almost a year practicing sleight of hand, palming coins, and taking rabbits out of hats. He had got, he had felt at the time, quite good at it. The point was that although Aziraphale was capable of doing things that could make the entire magic circle hand in their wands, he never applied what might be called his intrinsic powers to the practice of sleight-of-hand conjuring, which was a major drawback. He was beginning to wish that he'd continued practicing. Still, he mused, it was like riding a velocipede. You never forgot how. His magician's coat had been a little dusty, but it felt good once it was on. Even his old patter began to come back to him. The children watched him in blank, disdainful incomprehension. Behind the buffet, Crowley, in his white waiter's coat, cringed with contact embarrassment.
"Now then, young masters and mistresses, do you see my battered old top hat? What a shocking bad hat, as you young'uns do say. And see, there's nothing in it. But bless my britches, who's this rum customer? Why, it's our furry friend, Harry the Rabbit."
"It was in your pocket,"
pointed out Warlock. The other children nodded agreement. What did he think they were, kids? Aziraphale remembered what Maskelyne had told him about dealing with hecklers.
"Make a joke of it, you pudding heads, and I do mean you, Mr. Fell,"
the name Aziraphale had adopted at that time.
"Make 'em laugh, and they'll forgive you anything." "Oh, so you've rumbled my hat trick," he chuckled.
The children stared at him impassively.
"You're rubbish," said Warlock. "I wanted cartoons anyway."
"He's right, you know,"
agreed a small girl with a ponytail.
"You are rubbish, and probably a faggot."
Aziraphale stared desperately at Crowley. As far as he was concerned, young Warlock was obviously infernally tainted, and the sooner the black dog turned up and they could get away from this place, the better.
"Now, do any of you young'uns have such a thing as a threepenny bit about your persons?" "No, young master." "Then what's this I see behind your ear?" "I got cartoons at my birthday," announced the little girl. "And I got her Transformer, and a My Little Ponyer, and a Decepticon Attacker, and a Thunder Tank, and a..."
Crowley groaned. Children's parties were obviously places where any angel with an ounce of common sense should fear to tread. Piping infant voices were raised in cynical merriment as Aziraphale dropped three linked metal rings. Crowley looked away, and his gaze fell on a table heaped high with presents. From a tall plastic structure, two beady little eyes stared back at him. Crowley scrutinized them for a glint of red fire. You could never be certain when you were dealing with the bureaucrats of hell. It was always possible that they had sent a gerbil instead of a dog. No, it was a perfectly normal gerbil. It appeared to be living in an exciting construction of cylinders, spheres, and treadmills, such as the Spanish Inquisition would have devised if they'd had access to a plastics molding press. He checked his watch. It had never occurred to Crowley to change its battery, which had rotted away 3 years previously, but it still kept perfect time. It was 2:02. Aziraphale was getting more and more flustered.
"Do any of the company here assembled possess such a thing about their persons as a pocket handkerchief?" "No."
In Victorian days, it had been unheard of for people not to carry handkerchiefs, and the trick, which involved magically producing a dove who was even now pecking irritably at Azrael's wrist, could not proceed without one. The angel tried to attract Crowley's attention, failed, and in desperation, pointed to one of the security guards, who shifted uneasily.
You, my fine Jack Sauce, come here. Now, if you inspect your breast pocket, I think you might find a fine silk handkerchief.
No, sir. I'm afraid not, sir, said the guard, staring straight ahead. Azrael winked desperately.
No, go on, dear boy. Take a look, please.
The guard reached a hand inside his inside pocket, looked surprised, and pulled out a handkerchief, duck-egg blue silk with lace edging. Azrael realized almost immediately that the lace had been a mistake, as it caught on the guard's holstered gun, and sent it spinning across the room to land heavily in a bowl of jelly. The children applauded spasmodically.
Hey, not bad, said the ponytailed girl.
Warlock had already run across the room and grabbed the gun.
Hands up, dog breaths, he shouted gleefully.
The security guards were in a quandary. Some of them fumbled for their own weapons. Others started edging their way toward or away from the boy. The other children started complaining that they wanted guns as well, and a few of the more forward ones started trying to tug them from the guards, who had been thoughtless enough to take their weapons out. Then someone threw jelly at Warlock. The boy squeaked and pulled the trigger of the gun. It was a Magnum 32, CIA issue, gray, mean, heavy, capable of blowing a man away at 30 paces, and leaving nothing more than a red mist, a ghastly mess, and a certain amount of paperwork. Azrael blinked. A thin stream of water squirted from the nozzle and soaked Crowley, who had been looking out the window, trying to see if there was a huge black dog in the garden. Azrael looked embarrassed. Then a cream cake hit him in the face. It was almost 3:05. With a gesture, Azrael turned the rest of the guns into water pistols as well and walked out. Crowley found him on the pavement outside, trying to extricate a rather squishy dove from the arm of his frock coat.
It's late, said Azrael. I can see that, said Crowley. Comes of sticking it up your sleeve.
He reached out and pulled the limp bird from Azrael's coat and breathed life back into it. The dove cooed appreciatively and flew off, a trifle warily.
Not the bird, said the angel. The dog. It's late.
Crowley shook his head thoughtfully.
We'll see.
He opened the car door, flipped on the radio.
I should be so lucky, 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 lucky. I should be so lucky in...
Hello, Crowley.
Hello? Who is this?
Dagon, Lord of the Files, Master of Madness, Underduke of the Seventh Torment. What can I do for you?
The Hellhound. I'm just checking that it got off okay.
Released 10 minutes ago. Why? Hasn't it arrived? Is something wrong?
Oh, no. Nothing's wrong. Everything's fine. Oops. I can see it now.
Good dog. Nice dog. Everything's terrific. You're doing a great job down there, people. Well, lovely talking to you, Dagon. Catch you soon, huh?
He flipped off the radio. They stared at each other. There was a loud bang from inside the house, and a window shattered.
Oh, dear,
muttered Azrael, not swearing with the practiced ease of one who has spent 6,000 years not swearing, and who wasn't going to start now.
I must have missed one.
No dog, said Crowley.
No dog,
said Azrael. The demon sighed. Get in the car, he said. We've got to talk about this. Oh, and Azrael.
Yes?
Clean off that blasted cream cake before you get in. It was a hot, silent August day, far from central London.
by the side of the Tadfield Road, the dust weighed down the hogweed. Bees buzzed in the hedges. The air had a leftover and reheated feel. There was a sound like 1,000 metal voices shouting, "Hail!" cut off abruptly. And there was a black dog in the road. It had to be a dog. It was dog-shaped. There are some dogs which, when you meet them, remind you that, despite thousands of years of man-made evolution, every dog is still only 2 meals away from being a wolf. These dogs advance deliberately, purposefully, the wilderness made flesh, their teeth yellow, their breath a stink, while in the distance their owners whitter, "He's an old soppy, really, just poke him if he's a nuisance." And in the green of their eyes, the red campfires of the Pleistocene gleam and flicker. This dog would make even a dog like that slink nonchalantly behind the sofa and pretend to be extremely preoccupied with its rubber bone. It was already growling, and the growl was a low, rumbling snarl of spring-coiled menace, the sort of growl that starts in the back of one throat and ends up in someone else's. Saliva dripped from its jaws and sizzled on the tar. It took a few steps forward and sniffed the sullen air. Its ears flicked up. There were voices a long way off. A voice. A boyish voice, but one it had been created to obey, could not help but obey. When that voice said, "Follow," it would follow. When it said, "Kill," it would kill. His master's voice. It leaped the hedge and padded across the field beyond. A grazing bull eyed it for a moment, weighed its chances, then strolled hurriedly toward the opposite hedge. The voices were coming from a copse of straggly trees. The black hound slunk closer, jaws streaming. One of the other voices said, "He never will. You're always saying he will, and he never does. Catch your dad giving you a pet. An interest in pet, anyway. It'll probably be stick insects. That's your dad's idea of interestin'." The hound gave the canine equivalent of a shrug, but immediately lost interest, because now the master, the center of its universe, spoke. "It'll be a dog," it said. "Huh? You don't know it's going to be a dog. No one said it's going to be a dog. How do you know it's going to be a dog if no one said? Your dad would be complaining about the food it eats the whole time." "Privet." This third voice was rather more prim than the first two. The owner of a voice like that would be the sort of person who, before making a plastic model kit, would not only separate and count all the parts before commencing, as per the instructions, but also paint the bits that needed painting first and leave them to dry properly prior to construction. All that separated this voice from chartered accountancy was a matter of time. "They don't eat privet, Wensley. You never saw a dog eating privet." "Stick insects do, I mean. They're jolly interesting, actually. They eat each other when they're mating." There was a thoughtful pause. The hound slunk closer and realized that the voices were coming from a hole in the ground. The trees, in fact, concealed an ancient chalk quarry, now half overgrown with thorn trees and vines. Ancient, but clearly not disused. Tracks crisscrossed it. Smooth areas of slope indicated regular use by skateboards and wall of death, or at least wall of seriously grazed knee, cyclists. Old bits of dangerously frayed rope hung from some of the more accessible greenery. Here and there, sheets of corrugated iron and old wooden boards were wedged in branches. A burnt-out, rusting Triumph Herald estate was visible, half-submerged in a drift of nettles. In one corner, a tangle of wheels and corroded wire marked the site of the famous Lost Graveyard, where the supermarket trolleys came to die. If you were a child, it was paradise. The local adults called it the pit. The hound peered through a clump of nettles and spotted four figures sitting in the center of the quarry on that indispensable prop to good secret dens everywhere, the common milk crate.
They don't. They do. Bet you they don't,
said the first speaker. It had a certain timbre to it that identified it as young and female, and it was tinted with horrified fascination.
They do, actually. I had six before we went on holiday, and I forgot to change the privet, and when I came back, I had one big fat one. Nah, that's not stick insects. That's praying mantises. I saw on the television where this big female one ate this other one, and it didn't hardly take any notice.
There was another crowded pause.
What are they praying about? Said his master's voice.
Dunno. Praying they don't have to get married, I expect.
The hound managed to get one huge eye against an empty knothole in the quarry's broken-down fence and squinted downward.
Anyway, it's like with bikes,
said the first speaker authoritatively.
I thought I was going to get this bike with seven gears and one of them razor-blade saddles and purple paint and everything. And they gave me this light blue one with a basket. A girl's bike.
Well, you're a girl, said one of the others.
That's sexism, that is. Going around giving people girly presents just because they're a girl.
I'm going to get a dog, said his master's voice firmly.
His master had his back to him. The hound couldn't quite make out his features.
Oh, yeah, one of those great big Rottenweilers, yeah?
Said the girl with withering sarcasm.
No, it's going to be the kind of dog you can have fun with, said his master's voice.
Not a big dog.
The eye in the nettles vanished abruptly downwards.
But one of those dogs that's brilliantly intelligent and can go down rabbit holes and has one funny ear that always looks inside out. And a proper mongrel, too. A pedigree mongrel.
Unheard by those within, there was a tiny clap of thunder on the lip of the quarry. It might have been caused by the sudden rushing of air into the vacuum caused by a very large dog becoming, for example, a small dog. The tiny popping noise that followed might have been caused by one ear turning itself inside out.
And I'll call him, said his master's voice. I'll call him...
Yes, said the girl.
What are you going to call it?
The hound waited. This was the moment. The naming. This would give it its purpose, its function, its identity. Its eyes glowed a dull red, even though they were a lot closer to the ground, and it dribbled into the nettles.
I'll call him Dog, said his master, positively. It saves a lot of trouble, a name like that.
The hellhound paused. Deep in its diabolical canine brain, it knew that something was wrong, but it was nothing if not obedient, and its great sudden love of its master overcame all misgivings. Who was it to say what size it should be anyway? It trotted down the slope to meet its destiny. Strange, though, it had always wanted to jump up at people, but now it realized that, against all expectation, it wanted to wag its tail at the same time.
You said it was him,
moaned Aziraphale, abstractedly picking the final lump of cream cake from his lapel. He licked his fingers clean.
It was him, said Crowley. I mean, I should know, shouldn't I?
Then someone else must be interfering.
There isn't anyone else. There's just us, right? Good and evil, one side or the other.
He thumped the steering wheel.
You'll be amazed at the kind of things they can do to you down there, he said.
I imagine they're very similar to the sort of things they can do to one up there, said Aziraphale.
Come off it. Your lot get ineffable mercy,
said Crowley sourly.
Yes. Did you ever visit Gomorrah?
Sure, said the demon. There was this great little tavern where you could get these terrific fermented date palm cocktails with nutmeg and crushed lemongrass.
I meant afterwards.
Oh. Hazrafel said,
something must have happened in the hospital.
It couldn't have. It was full of our people.
Whose people?
Said Hazrafel coldly. My people, corrected Crowley. Well, not my people. You know, Satanists. He tried to say it dismissively. Apart from, of course, the fact that the world was an amazing, interesting place, which they both wanted to enjoy for as long as possible, there were few things that the two of them agreed on. But they did see eye to eye about some of those people who, for one reason or another, were inclined to worship the Prince of Darkness. Crowley always found them embarrassing. You couldn't actually be rude to them, but you couldn't help feeling about them the same way that, say, a Vietnam veteran would feel about someone who wears combat gear to neighborhood watch meetings. Besides, they were always so depressingly enthusiastic. Take all that stuff with the inverted crosses and pentagrams and cockerels. It mystified most demons. It wasn't the least bit necessary. All you needed to become a Satanist was an effort of will. You could be one all your life without ever knowing what a pentagram was, without ever seeing a dead cockerel other than as chicken moringo. Besides, some of the old-style Satanists tended, in fact, to be quite nice people. They mouthed the words and went through the motions, just like the people they thought of as their opposite numbers, and then went home and lived lives of mild, unassuming mediocrity for the rest of the week, with never an unusually evil thought in their heads. And as for the rest of it, there were people who called themselves Satanists who made Crowley squirm. It wasn't just the things they did, it was the way they blamed it all on hell. They'd come up with some stomach-churning idea that no demon could have thought of in 1,000 years, some dark and mindless unpleasantness that only a fully functioning human brain could conceive, then shout, "The devil made me do it," and get the sympathy of the court, when the whole point was that the devil hardly ever made anyone do anything. He didn't have to. That was what some humans found hard to understand. Hell wasn't a major reservoir of evil, any more than heaven, in Crowley's opinion, was a fountain of goodness. They were just sides in the great cosmic chess game, where you found the real McCoy, the real Grace, and the real heart-stopping evil was right inside the human mind.
Huh, said Azrafael. Satanists.
I don't see how they could have messed it up, said Crowley. I mean, two babies. It's not exactly taxing, is it? He stopped. Through the mists of memory, he pictured a small nun who had struck him at the time as being remarkably loose-headed even for a Satanist. And there had been someone else. Crowley vaguely recalled a pipe and a cardigan with the kind of zigzag pattern that went out of style in 1938, a man with expectant father written all over him. There must have been a third baby, he told Azrafael.
Not a lot to go on, said the angel.
We know the child must be alive, said Crowley. So,
how do we know?
If it had turned up down there again, do you think I'd still be sitting here?
Good point.
So, all we've got to do is find it, said Crowley. Go through the hospital records. The Bentley's engine coughed into life, and the car leaped forward, forcing Azrafael back into the seat.
And then what?
He said. And then we find the child.
And then what?
The angel shut his eyes as the car crabbed around the corner. Don't know.
Good grief,
I suppose.
Get off the road, you clown.
Your people wouldn't consider.
Have the scooter you rode in on.
Giving me asylum? I was going to ask you the same thing.
Watch out for that pedestrian.
It's on the street. It knows the risks it's taking, said Crowley, easing the accelerating car between a parked car and a taxi, and leaving a space which would have barely accepted even the best credit card.
Watch the road! Watch the road! Where is this hospital, anyway?
Somewhere south of Oxford. Azrafael grabbed the dashboard.
You can't do 90 miles an hour in central London.
Crowley peered at the dial. Why not? He said.
You'll get us killed.
Azrafael hesitated.
Inconveniently discorporated,
he corrected, lamely, relaxing a little.
Anyway, you might kill other people.
Crowley shrugged. The angel had never really come to grips with the 20th century, and didn't realize that it is perfectly possible to do 90 miles an hour down Oxford Street. You just arranged matters so that no one was in the way. And since everyone knew that it was impossible to do 90 miles an hour down Oxford Street, no one noticed. At least cars were better than horses. The internal combustion engine had been a windfall for Crowley. The only horses he could be seen riding on business in the old days were big black jobs with eyes like flame and hooves that struck sparks. That was de rigueur for a demon. Usually, Crowley fell off. He wasn't much good with animals. Somewhere around Chiswick, Azrafael scrabbled vaguely in the scree of tapes in the glove compartment.
What's a velvet underground?
He said. You wouldn't like it, said Crowley.
Oh,
said the angel dismissively. Bebop. Do you know, Azrafael, that probably if a million human beings were asked to describe modern music, they wouldn't use the term bebop? Said Crowley.
Ah, this is more like it. Tchaikovsky,
said Azrafael, opening a case and slotting its cassette into the Blaupunkt. You won't enjoy it, sighed Crowley. It's been in the car for more than a fortnight. A heavy bass beat began to thump through the Bentley as they sped past Heathrow. Azrafael's brow furrowed.
I don't recognize this, he said. What is it?
It's Tchaikovsky's Another One Bites the Dust, said Crowley, closing his eyes as they went through Slough. To while away the time, as they crossed the sleeping Chilterns, they also listened to William Byrd's We Are the Champions and Beethoven's I Want to Break Free. Neither were as good as Vaughan Williams's Fat-Bottomed Girls. It is said that the devil has all the best tunes. This is broadly true, but heaven has the best choreographers. The Oxfordshire plain stretched out to the west, with a scattering of lights to mark the slumbering villages where honest yeomen were settling down to sleep after a long day's editorial direction, financial consulting, or software engineering. Up here on the hill, a few glowworms were lighting up. The surveyor's theodolite is one of the more direful symbols of the 20th century. Set up anywhere in open countryside, it says, there will come road widening, yea, and 2,000 home estates in keeping with the essential character of the village. Executive developments will be manifest. But not even the most conscientious surveyor surveys at midnight. And yet, here the thing was, tripod legs deep in the turf. Not many theodolites have a hazel twig strapped to the top, either, or crystal pendulums hanging from them and Celtic runes carved into the legs. The soft breeze flapped the cloak of the slim figure who was adjusting the knobs of the thing. It was quite a heavy cloak, sensibly waterproof, with a warm lining. Most books on witchcraft will tell you that witches work naked. This is because most books on witchcraft are written by men.
The young woman's name was Anathema Device. She was not astonishingly beautiful. All her features, considered individually, were extremely pretty, but the entirety of her face gave the impression that it had been put together hurriedly from stock, without reference to any plan. Probably the most suitable word is attractive, although people who knew what it meant and could spell it might add vivacious, although there is something very 50s about vivacious, so perhaps they wouldn't. Young women should not go alone on dark nights, even in Oxfordshire. But any prowling maniac would have had more than his work cut out if he had accosted Anathema Device. She was a witch, after all. And precisely because she was a witch, and therefore sensible, she put little faith in protective amulets and spells. She saved it all for a foot-long bread knife, which she kept in her belt. She sighted through the glass and made another adjustment. She muttered under her breath. Surveyors often mutter under their breath. They mutter things like, "Soon have a relief road through here faster than you can say Jack Robinson," or, "That's 3.5 meters, give or take a gnat's whisker." This was an entirely different kind of muttering. "Darksome night and shining moon," muttered Anathema, "east by south, by west by southwest, west southwest, got you." She picked up a folded ordnance survey map and held it in the torchlight. Then she produced a transparent ruler and a pencil and carefully drew a line across the map. It intersected another pencil line. She smiled. Not because anything was particularly amusing, but because a tricky job had been done well. Then she collapsed the strange theodolite, strapped it onto the back of a sit-up-and-beg black bicycle leaning against the hedge, made sure the book was in the basket, and wheeled everything out to the misty lane.